behaviorology, to assist the criminal and civil justice systems, to improve our society. A podcast like no other. Here is your host, Timothy Joseph.
Well, we're here with Hank Neuer, who has a varied career, but the subject I wanted to talk with him about is hazing. So, Hank, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Hank, tell me what your career has been. Have you been a writer? You do plays? What kind of careers have you had?
Well, it's been pretty consistent as an author, 26 books, and as a professor. And I've taught at Clemson, University of Richmond, Ball State, but mostly at Franklin College. And I was there from 2002 to 2020 when COVID hit. Then now I'm a professor emeritus. I'm involved with the theater department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and which has been enjoyable. Mm-hmm. I get to work with young people, but I don't have to grade their papers.
That's ideal.
Yeah. And so now I have a new chapter coming out this year. It's called Hazing in the New Millennia. Mm-hmm. It is one of chapters of many related to sports hazing in the United States and Canada, and that includes looking at the criminal laws that govern. And there isn't really such local hazing laws in Canada, although that's changing, compared to the United States, where we have 44 states with laws and about a dozen with felony hazing written into it. So that's one. And then number two, I write biographies, not as many. The 1990 book, Broken Pledges, The Wrongs of Broken Pledges. When I tried to do that book, I did it as a biography of Eileen Stevens. And she was a mother who lost her son in a hazing at Alfred University. Mm-hmm. And at first she did research trying to close the Greek system down, which mm-hmm. a couple of others have tried. And then, as she was talking at universities, got involved with young people and moved to change the system. And so that was made into a TV movie and my first biography. And then I did one on Jesse Owens. And now I'm doing a biography of Kurt Vonnegut, which is overwhelming in terms of, it's already 200,000 words. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping to just abandon it, not finish it in August. Mm-hmm.
I hope you finish it. I'm sure it'll be quite interesting. It's a very interesting person.
Things change all the time. My chapter on General Electric, for example, just today, with the company dissolving, has to be rewritten. I'll do that tonight.
Wow. Just quickly, how would we define what hazing is? And it's a subject I really haven't thought a lot about, but it appears there's a lot of death and injury involved with this. So just as a definition for your research, what would you say hazing is?
Okay, well, first a precursor, and that is, that's one of the most difficult things when it comes to getting a hazing law passed state mm-hmm. to state, and that is agreeing on a definition. Mm-hmm. What we'll be talking about here might not hold up in a court of law, but I'm trying to simplify it. Mm-hmm. So hazing essentially is any behavior or ritual that is required of a newcomer by the veteran group in order to be accepted into the group. Mm-hmm. And for example, in sports hazing, you are already a member of the team in terms of the coach assigning you a position, but you haven't been, in a hazing culture, accepted by your teammates until you go through an activity that can be silly, dangerous, offensive, abusive, or all of the above.
Is hazing something to be distinguished from bullying? Is it a subcategory of it? What do you think about that?
No, that's a great question. And for example, the death of Max Gruver 7 years ago at Louisiana State University, I would call it a combination of bullying and hazing. Here's why. The principal person who was involved, Matthew Nakin, who was a fraternity member at Phi Delta Theta, took a dislike to Max Gruver, Maxwell Gruver, and was putting him through all kinds, according to court testimony, was putting him through all kinds of ordeals. The final ordeal was to answer questions and making him drink each time he, quote unquote, got something wrong. And we're talking very potent alcohol. And he was hoping to get, hazing is often a welcoming activity, quote unquote, right? But this one was to try to get him to quit. And I see that totally from your question as bullying and hazing, with fatal consequences.
And I was at one point later on, I think I'll ask this now, just, and maybe we'll revisit it, the motives for hazing. Because the impression I got reading some of these, and I thought I'd just go through them. There's so many cases and so many videos out there, but it's not like a possible motive would be to weed out people that won't be loyal to the group by having them go through this. But just in your research, what do you think about the motives that you see for hazing?
Weed out would be one possibility. In my college hazing, it was called toughening you up. By that, 18 and 19 and 20 year old veterans think that they are changing you for the better, as if this were a military organization. And so there's a lot of justifications, rationalizations that go along with hazing. And then the other one that you hear all the time, especially with sports, it's a tradition. And for me, with fraternities, somewhat with sororities, it's a mathematical equation. Pledging equals hazing, hazing equals pledging, that you often don't have one without the other.
So to weed out the disloyal or toughening people up is a rationalization. Do you think there's any deeper motive for it that goes on here?
There are scholars who do think so. That was Lionel Tiger, for example. He was a professor at Rutgers. He believes that it's been a part of the socialization going for years. There's a professor now, Aldo Cimino, who has some very interesting theories about hazing. And he's done a lot of studies, a lot of surveys, a lot of questioning of individuals involved in hazing. And I think I've done it more simplified because I'm a hazing historian, meaning I'm the one that tracks the hazing deaths. And even now, a work in progress is to have a database of hazing deaths from the beginning all the way on up now. That's in about another 2 years to get that done. And that'll be for the website that I have. So mine is probably more simplified in that I look at the data and look at the numbers. So I'm looking at it not so much as a social scientist, as a journalist or a historian.
What prompted you to take an interest in this area?
It was definitely a single thing. The hazing I had wouldn't be considered criminal. And we didn't have alcohol, for example, that we had to have. That really entered after I graduated from college, when the drinking laws went from 18 to 21, with Louisiana being the last state, if I remember correctly. And that's when they went up. And I don't know if it's a combination of rebellion, disobedience, or whatever, but when alcohol entered the picture, everything ramped up. Which, to answer your question, 1975, I was a graduate student at the University of Nevada at Reno. I was in touch with the undergraduates because for 1 year I was president of the Graduate Student Association and we put on events together. But I also played intramural sports, including some practices with a group called the Sundowners. And at that time, when you're in college, you call everybody your friends. Right now, I would call them acquaintances. And some of the athletes and the undergraduate representatives got involved in a tradition of high alcohol. And I walked into a bar called the Little Waldorf and saw them pouring Everclear into people's mouths and horrified when I saw someone throw a match and flames was bursting out. But then I found a pledge under at the pool table who was foaming at the mouth. First and only time in my life I've ever seen anyone foam at the mouth from alcohol or be that intoxicated. I was pretty scared, and I didn't really know alcohol could kill you, but I thought that maybe it could make you blind and certainly could cause damage. And this kid was in trouble. I didn't have to force anybody. I just said, look, which was difficult because the members were all drunk. But I found the least drunk people and the bartender and got them to walk this guy around. I don't know if that was part of it or whatever, but they decided to hold the next initiation on a Native American reservation at Pyramid Lake, and no one in charge. And one pledge, John Davies, died October 1975, and another pledge had some partial brain damage, and he later died as a pedestrian in an auto accident. So Davies was the impetus. I contacted Human Behavior magazine, homework first, and made my first database of deaths, which at that time was under 30 that I could find. Right now, I think I'm up to about 280 deaths. And 30 at that time did the database and published it in Human Behavior magazine, which is kind of like Psychology Today or more for a popular audience. And the mail I got, both encouraging and hearing from a mother who had lost her son, Eileen Stevens, that I mentioned, and castigated by executives from fraternities. They got a lot of mail, to put it mildly. And I kept at the database. Eventually, I got a Gannett Foundation through the database, Gannett Foundation grant, and did my first book on it called Broken Pledges.
I was wondering about resistance to that, to these stories, if you got any of that from the fraternity institutions, maybe from colleges or other organizations. Were you getting some bad feedback on some of your writings?
The worst was a death threat out of Georgia, and somebody who didn't know how to protect his IP address, and I contacted the FBI, and that was the worst. On to a lot of people coming forward, which helped me with the research, saying what they had gone through, which something which very useful. Hey, you missed this one. Hey, you missed this death. This one here was called, and here's the big thing why I missed it. This one was called initiation. This one was called an accident. And most of the ones that I missed were called unfortunate accidents. The word hazing was not used. And so if I didn't invent that term, but I brought it back because it was really a common term back in 1900, 1910, 1930, the word initiation seemed to have taken over in the 60s. I never heard the word hazing when I was a pledge. What I heard was initiation.
Initiation. That was another area of interest that I had is the accuracy. In other words, are there incidences of deaths from initiations that you are suspicious really are hazing, but they have been successfully covered up or poorly investigated?
Yes, prior to 1960. I've got a short list that I keep that when I guess you'd call it a round to it, when I get around to it, that I think they need to be explored. Here's an example. There was a group from a southern university where their tradition was to send the best pledge, quote unquote, out with the members to like a drinking convention of other fraternities with the same name. And they were drinking and were killed in a car accident. I haven't included that now, but I want to take a look at it. And part of that is what went before and what went after. Of course, it's a tragic accident, and that's what it was called. But should it have happened? No. Should there have been that much alcohol use? I think it was actually called sleep deprivation for the driver that died. And if you've looked at my chart, sleep deprivation has been very common, just like alcohol use. Very common. What else you might have noticed is that there were no alcohol-related deaths until 1940 in terms of hazing. Then, if you take a look after 1968, you see it going off the chart. When you look at my research on sexual hazing, the first one I was able to find, so the first one that I could find was 1982, Nogales, Arizona, because it went to court and it was baseball coaches that were on trial. They were let go, but that's the first time I got any sexual hazing cases. By the end of the 80s, I had a lot. And now you can't read a newspaper during football season and football camp season without hearing two, three, four sexual attacks during hazing.
So among the activities that go on in hazing, we have the excessive drinking, you have sexual activity, sexual abuse, physical abuse. What else have you found?
For a lot, I find the mental hazing disturbing. And you have people with post-traumatic stress associated with it. You have a handful of suicides where the parents are convinced that hazing was the cause. This would be hazing of pledges, such as John DeLuca at the University of Washington, but also members a year later who were feeling guilt about what they had done. This is really unusual. I forget the word. It's de-individuation, where basically the whole group is together. When I did 1990, I interviewed Irving Janis, the groupthink expert, and I was using that word. But maybe this is a better term to use. But the whole idea is where people lose their collective self in a group and do things that they would find abhorrent as individuals. But together, they go along with it. It doesn't mean that they are approving it. In the death of a young man at Western Illinois University in a lacrosse club incident, he died, and his mother asked the judge to have a journalist, namely me, to write about this. So I went back and I did the initiation minus the alcohol, which was basically, I don't know, 15, 14 bottles that were at different stations, a lot. And I went into the river, did that, went through the fields, went to each of the fraternity houses. This is interesting. These were athletes, but they were also fraternity members. And so, for example, this young man, his name is Nick Hobben, Haben, H A B E N, had to drink, quote unquote, rookie sauce at one of the houses. Well, this was a chapter, a fraternity chapter, that put in all these concoctions and hot peppers and things into too, that had alcohol, schnapps, and so on. That was a fraternity hazing exercise, but it was brought into the sports team. And so here's the part that was interesting. When I did the interviews for the book, which became High School Hazing with a section on sports hazing, because that's the book contract I could get, I would have done it elsewhere, but the only interest I had was for a title called High School Hazing. That was Scholastic Press. And most of the guys pointed the finger at the acting student coach, who would not be interviewed, would not talk. And all of them said, we wanted to step in, but we wanted somebody else to step in, and then we would do it. None of them said that they were very gleeful about this. I don't know if that's somebody's conscience later, but they were pointing fingers at one person, the one who would not speak. And this individual, I thought, should have been prosecuted by the school, because you could see that he was falsifying gasoline for the you know, for their road trips, and putting it into his car and some of the others. Even a minor charge would have been nice. So what happened here is they didn't have to go to jail from this judge, because they talked to the journalist at the mother's request. But to me, in hindsight, I think this one guy should have gone on trial. And even later, since he didn't participate in this, I think he should have. But you need a prosecuting attorney who's going to take it forward.
As far as that goes, with prosecutions, how do the prosecutors, law enforcement, I know there's been some changes in the laws in some of the states, how receptive are they to prosecuting over hazing deaths? How has that gone?
It can take a year of your time. And until recently, with the laws being strengthened by the state legislatures in 12 states, 12 of the 44, you often didn't get any significant jail time unless with it you could get reckless endangerment, or unless you could get assault. But for the most part, it's giving alcohol to a minor. And, you know, in a lot of those deaths, that long list, you'll see that there were attempts to prosecute, and basically they'll settle jail time being under 30 days, and often none.
And I would think, at least reading through some of these, is the defense that the victim wanted to participate in this.
Yes, and that's the hazing activists. Advocates will say to you that that's impossible, that this is a form of coercion. Defense lawyers will try to say, this boy had a history of drinking before, jumped into it willingly. It's interesting, for example, the death of Chad Meredith, University of Florida, alcohol involved in a drowning. There was a big, huge award of over $13 million in a civil suit. However, they did take away some of it, saying it was Chad's fault. So you do have that case on record. You know, for me, I'm just covering it, but it's getting more and more difficult for fraternities to have as a defense that the victim was a willing participant.
And that is because you think the prosecutors and others are becoming more savvy, more aware of what's going on with hazing?
hazing advocates, all of whom have lost their sons or in one case paralyzed, have really educated the prosecutors. This would be the family of Timothy Piazza at Penn State, the parents of Max Gruver at Louisiana State that I mentioned before, Leanne Kowiak, whose son Harrison Kowiak died in a fraternity, but during a at-night football game played with rocks, where he fell and hit his head. And that was another case where justice wasn't really served. But she's out there educating prosecutors, educating college presidents. These people have a lot, I admire them, have a lot of energy, and they speak at 40, 50 schools a year.
And I was going to ask you about that one, the Timothy Piazza, here on Wikipedia, the Penn State fraternity hazing scandal involves a case related to Timothy Piazza, who died February 4th, 2017, as a result of hazing at the Beta Theta Pi fraternity at Pennsylvania State University, University Park in Pennsylvania. The incident led to closure of the fraternity's chapter at the university, and at least 26 members of the fraternity had charges of involuntary manslaughter dropped by a presiding judge. You have any other recollections of that case? Seemed like a lot happened.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. Well, number one, disclosure, 2 years before this incident, Beta Theta Pi invited me to Oxford, Ohio, to their anti-hazing camp. This would have been for a week. And I was supposed to keep my identity quiet until the last day. I wasn't really introduced except by my name. And I went through the ropes course. We went through a quasi-football game, which is more like rugby, that they invented. All these, and a lot of speakers, a lot of positives, a lot of warnings about what could go wrong. Some great guys, really, really good individuals. I enjoyed it, learned from it. And then the last day, they let me talk to the group, saying that I was the author of Broken Pledges. I told them what the book was, and then I talked about my research. So that was... that was really disheartening when there was a death in Beta Theta Pi. And I can imagine how it really hit those national leaders. You know, it's like, what else could we have done, right? And so there was that. And that would be a classic case where there was complete indifference to Piazza's body as he lay at the foot of the stairs after a fall, terrible spleen injury and other injuries, and people either walked over him, some nudged him. There were young women at this party. Nobody made the call. And apparently the prosecution thought that there wasn't enough duty to care here. Was I surprised? Yes. I wrote about this, and I got to really like and know the Piazzas, but at first they didn't. I was reporting as a journalist. The advisor, who was also an athletic trainer for Penn State football, was upstairs as Piazza was dying and never came down to check. He did resign his position, went elsewhere, was never charged. Never charged, was never really accused of a crime, except by the father, who had made quite a few comments. And I interviewed his lawyer and did an article on that. So I guess the point here is, what might have a conviction in one district, one state, one court, didn't happen here with Piazza, where Matthew Naquin, if memory serves, got a 6-year sentence, I believe. Anyway, multi-year, significantly over 5 years for Phi Delta Theta. the piazzas got, as you said, nothing. Bad publicity would be what they got. And that's true for today. What happens here in Alaska, where we don't have a law, the Democratic Party, which is the a minority here, tried to get a hazing law done about 2009, and I was involved with that. I'm involved several times with state attempts trying to give background, and it went nowhere. There's right now a lot of blowback from certain legislators who say we have enough laws. Number one, they call themselves conservative. We have enough laws, and they don't see that hazing is different from some of the other laws. That's one where I would give my opinion that having a hazing law is a deterrent, especially if it's a felony. And it's also something that gives the parents ammunition. But there have been hazing laws going back to the end of the 1890s, and they were seldom invoked, really, until Eileen Stevens started going after it after her 1978 death.
Does having large numbers of people involved in an incident make it more difficult to prosecute?
Well, it's easier for them to have one story. They're on their cell phones. Several cases, the cell phones have been confiscated, but the perpetrators don't want to give up the combination to the phone. So it's not broken. But yes, the big groups are problematic. And the other part, though, which you might not know, is how long they take before they call for 911. The cover-up starts early. Case of the Texas Cowboys, the first one, they've had two deaths. The first one involving Gabe Higgins, who was a fraternity member and a Texas Cowboy. Texas Cowboy meaning the guys who blow the cannon off after a touchdown, and they do charitable work. Tom Landry was a member, a lot of prestigious lawyers. And they've since had a second death. But with that particular group, I think it was 12 hours before they called 911, but they called their fathers, who were attorneys, pretty quickly. There was this big gap, which was amazing to me. This is not the first time that they delay in calling for help.
They called their fathers first before they called for emergency services.
Right. That's I think it's your act. I can't say it's criminal behavior, but you're sure not acting ethically.
I think it very well could be. Well, that makes me think that loyalty to the group or desire to prevent to protect the group name, the family name, is a big motive with
It
these
is.
defenses.
Yeah, when I was doing my speaking, which I don't do anymore, I get into the ethics of things, and we talk about loyalty and how it can be positive, and how I use the mafia example, how it can be detrimental to a group and an individual.
You
And
did you say the mafia example?
yeah, that was the example. And then so with it, I did a skit, and I would, for example, Oklahoma State. It was a big crowd, about 1,200 people, and I had some come up, and we put them into that situation where someone is down. How should you react? How do you think? Why do you think that people don't react? We had some really good discussion, that particular one. Very open discussion. And the fact is, they're scared. The leader who tries to get them to cover up is considered an authority right there. They may be consulting with a lawyer already who says, say nothing. In Penn State, it was very controversial. There was in the news for a while that a member had erased some of the security footage. Now, and I think he went did some small jail time for that. But covering up, getting rid of the evidence, that's very common.
Well, that's interesting that you kind of have that mafia example, because I'm a behavior analyst of sorts, and I think a kind of conditioning might be at work where they are each person goes through this. They may have had close calls before where someone almost dies, or they think, and then they cover it up, the person lives. You have so many of those situations, and then you finally have one that's fatal or brings about serious injury, but they're still following what they've been conditioned to do. We'll go to the leader, we'll keep quiet, and then you have a tragic result.
Exactly. And even when we don't have a death, you have a case involving Danny Santoli, University of Missouri, and his hazing. He's now in a vegetative state, can't speak, in a wheelchair. I mean, they're trying to bring him back, but he will never be the young man he once was, a productive member of society. I find that just as tragic, if not more so than a death, for that family and the ongoing expenses that they'll have. But I go inside the mind of a Danny Santoli, and I think what a loss for him, for society. You sometimes wonder how the hazers can go on. I have not heard of any hazer, and I've really tried to research it, who's committed suicide afterwards, but many, by many over 15, who've gone out and spoken at high schools or so forth, and really felt guilty, that they wake up in the morning and that's the first thing they think of every day.
Yeah, the legacy of that stays with the hazers. Do you think the victims realize the kind of danger they're putting themselves in when they engage in something like this?
Mixed. I mean, you have people with different, I guess, different risk-taking personalities. And so for some, being called the outstanding pledge, being able to drink the most, go through the most ordeal, and still come out laughing, or even reverse hazing, taking the brothers out and doing that to them, which is often encouraged, this reverse hazing, that is a stimulating kind of thing. And you've got the brothers saying, well, here's our future president. We got a good one here.
Yeah, so there's a lot of reinforcement for surviving one of these incidences, one of these hazing events, and I can kind of see that now. I want to see if I can jog your memory with another case if I am able to find it here. The one of it is, pardon me, Chun Michael Deng grew up in Queens, New York. This is courtesy of ABC News. As an only child in the first generation immigrant family from China, excelled in academics and athletics, decided to stay in New York City for college, enrolling in Baruch College, part of New York City. On the morning of December 8th, 2013, as his first semester of freshman year drew to a close, a mother got an unexpected call that her son had been rushed to Pennsylvania Hospital with traumatic injuries. The next day, Michael Ding died. Unbeknownst to Miss Mary Ding, her son pledging the Asian American fraternity Pi Delta Psi at Baruch. You familiar with that case?
They were rented a house in the Poconos, great deal of alcohol, but there was also I think he had resisted at some point, and there was some beating, serious beating involved here. A beating has been a part of it going back Even before the John Davies case. And John Davies was seriously beaten at the University of Nevada, Reno, before he died of alcohol poisoning. Mm-hmm. By a single pledge, which to me was showing a sadistic mindset, you know, because you got a big guy, John Davies, and he can't hit you back. Mm-hmm. And he was really pummeled. Mm-hmm. Sleep deprived, and then forced to drink. And if you're a non-drinker, you know, your tolerance is not going to be with someone who's drinking 5 days a week is. So that was a problem. And with the Deng one, that was pure brutality, cover up. Apparently. A tradition, a short tradition. This fraternity had not been around that long,
right?
I have done some research on Asian American, some of the Hispanic groups. They are starting to get, and have been in a couple of cases, involved in hazing education. But one of the national Hispanic one still has in its constitution that you have to eat the apple of truth, which means eat a whole onion before you can come in. And I think, how can they educate if that's in their constitution?
To eat an entire onion.
Yeah, the apple of truth.
Apple of truth is a whole onion. Yeah.
There's a lot of euphemisms with these. Hazing is called, you know, we were talking about the word for it, the specific kinds of hazing often have stupid names attached to it.
Well, you have, of the different types you have on your website, you have high school hazing, occupational hazing deaths, military deaths by hazing, Masonic and other societies, and you did mention sports and band hazing.
Right. All of those have seen fatalities. I've seen it in the Catholic Youth Organization, which was a part of when I was back in a seminary. Mm-hmm. I've seen it in Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. There aren't a lot there, but there should be none. And you have, if you check my page, especially the first page prior to 2000, coaches involved. Here in Fairbanks, oh my gosh, as soon as I got here and people found out about the hazing, I heard from other journalists, did you write about the pool hazing here? I said, no, I look it up, and it was called a team building exercise, not hazing. And they threw, the coach had kids at this high school thrown into the pool with sweaters on. They had to take them off, put them back on. And when three kids were struggling, he stopped a lifeguard and his assistant coaches from intervening, let them work it out. Luckily, the coaches did intervene. The kids were hospitalized. This moron was, he resigned. He wouldn't have lasted very long, but he had been in the military, thought what he was doing was team building. Mm-hmm. For me, utterly moronic, and I've written about this case, of course, but I can't get into that mindset.
In this modern age, we're on the web right now, do you think there could be hazing even if the people aren't physically present with each other?
It happened with COVID, where they were hazing people long distance. Trying to keep the thing going. So yes, absolutely. We didn't have any deaths that way. There were duties that happened.
Right. So that's one of the things, is having them do some kind of a difficult servitude. Task. Yeah. Servitude.
Or silly, like for us, we did have getting dropped off in the country, but a couple of members warned us, always keep coins in your socks. You know, that would be one I went through.
We had that in the Boy Scouts where they took some guy, they called it snipe hunting.
We did that too.
took him out in the woods and did bad. I think they ripped his shirt off or something and chased him through the woods at night. I just thought that was just cruelty.
Yeah, we had that, and then they had us the new ones. We had to clean the latrines, that kind of thing. But they also had a dangerous one for Boy Scouts. At the time, I didn't call it a hazing; it was called initiation. But this was rather scary. We were given brooms, and the members had paddles. The older Scouts, Buffalo, New York, exactly Cheektowaga, New York, which is a suburb. And we stood on a log, like a log. It wasn't a log, but it was a platform, but very thin, and had to battle them. Well, of course, we got knocked off into the water from the oars, and I was dinged, hit the side of the head. And I went under the water and came up under an upturned rowboat in the middle. I don't know why it was there, but it was. And I was gasping for air at the top of the rowboat because I'd also had the wind knocked out of me and never thought of reporting that, of course. Took air, came out, swam. No one said anything. I didn't say anything. I was just like, phew, close call. Never told my parents. When that comes back. But yes, we had snipe hunts.
Do you have people you've encountered that to this day praise hazing? Or see it as a positive thing and hear a conversation like this and want to defend it.
Well, the way I would put it is most of the guys that were in my fraternity at Buffalo State, a lot of them are in touch. A lot of them are supportive of what I do. A lot of them are horrified that it's gotten to such a bad condition. But there are five who will never talk to me again as a result of this, that this is disloyal to be talking about these kind of things.
Well, what would they say to all these deaths and injuries?
Oh, they just don't talk to me.
Don't talk about it.
But for the most part, I have a lot of support from particularly from a handful of members that I'm in touch with practically every day. And it's interesting. I mean, these are important to us, fraternities, sorority, sports. I'm still in touch with the guys from the baseball team at Buffalo State where I played. Still in touch with the fraternity members. These undergraduate relationships are important right to the end, and it's no surprise that we, including myself, are donors to our universities. And that whenever there's an incident and a fraternity is going to be expelled, there are wealthy, much wealthier than I, donors saying that they're going to stop their contributions to the university, or actually suing. There was a suit at Beta Theta Pi over the house itself.
To protect the house after it was going to be closed due to a hazing incident.
Exactly. And then talk about a lack of, I don't know, public relations, for want of a better word. The alumni came back to that house to have a party after the death. After it was closed. Okay. Yeah, these are things you can't make up. There's always something you can't make up. I'm a columnist as well for a paper in Indiana. And my column tomorrow is about a mother who murdered, poisoned her daughter because her and had previously poisoned her husband, killed him, but poisoned the daughter because the man she married, who was best friends of her ex-husband, her late husband. She killed the daughter because the daughter didn't get along with the new husband. Okay, what can't I believe? Her sentence was commuted. You can't make these things up. She wanted to be buried, and she is on the gravestone with her dead daughter. I mean, this is, I just think of a Stephen King situation right here. You can't make some of these things up. And then the hazing deaths, it's often a collision of the bizarre and sensational. And that's how it hits the press, because the kid is covered in vomit, number one, or in crazy costumes. There was one that died in New Jersey wearing a Playgirl costume. That's why these incidents get into the press, because they are so often bizarre. The alcohol ones, to me, are bizarre but also criminal. When you're asking somebody to drink 40 or more shots, good Lord, it would kill both of us to do something like that. And it's a wonder that more deaths don't occur.
Yeah, that's another thing. I'm surprised it's not, it could very well happen more, just by luck, it's not happening more than it is.
Well, one of the things that's good about what the advocates are doing, and I hope what I'm doing, is that they're likely to take somebody to the hospital at certain signs. They're often surprised. They don't understand that somebody, when you ask them to drink that much and chug it of hard alcohol, that you go from standing to crumpled very quickly, or asleep, which is totally dangerous. And then they often choke to death on their own vomit.
Yeah, just the awareness of it then could be saving lives.
No, I think that's true.
Yeah. Well, then thank you, Hank, for what you're doing and for the advocates are doing this. I was not aware of the magnitude of it. So I thank you for doing this education, and probably I'm certain you're saving lives.
Well, thank you. I hope so. We haven't had any deaths now in 2 years, but again, there's the Danny Santoli situation. There's been a lot of close calls. This is more no deaths by the grace of God, more than anything else.
For sure. But with the help of you and the advocacy and the families, I think some of that has something to do with it too.
And so I should mention, besides my work, the Clery Center is doing an awful lot of things about hazing. A lot of information up there that you can look at. Stophazing.org, another one. Hazingprevention.org, HPO.org. And they are doing the Hank Neuer Award for groups that and individuals that are fighting hazing. Those are some of the ones that you can look at. And if you want more information about the advocates, you can Google the Piazzas. You can Google the Groovers, Leon Kowiak, because there's a chance that somebody watching this may want a speaker. Said, I don't do it, any others. There's a group called is it Greek University? They have hazing speakers. Yeah, bring them to your school.
I may list I'll list those in our highlights for the podcast, those connections, so people can get a hold of those.
That'd be great.
All
Well,
right.
thank you.
And
It's been a pleasure.
thank you. And your new book, Hazing in the New Millennia.
Yes, and that's going to be coming out 2024.
2024, Hazing in the New Millennia. Hank Neuer. Thank you, Hank. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
It's been a pleasure.
This has been Criminal Behaviorology. Check us out on Podomatic.com or Anchor.fm. Please send questions, comments, and requests for transcripts to criminalbehaviorology@gmail.com.